Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll, and let's do it. The much anticipated Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Hey, Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling. Hope you're doing well. Hope everybody is doing well out there in, you know, in Chris Jericho land. Listen, you know, we got the new dog, Hadley. He ate all the Scrabble pieces, so I took him to the vet. No word yet. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
All right. Thank you, Duff, for making us laugh. Maybe not today, but most Fridays, every Friday, at least Duff sends in a joke. And today on the show... You got it. The original Ghostbuster actor Ernie Hudson makes his Talk is Jericho debut.
Ray, when someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes.
Ernie plays Winston Zeddemore, and he, Bill Murray, and Dan Aykroyd are back in the jumpsuits and proton packs for the new Ghostbusters Frozen Empire movie. Ernie has so many stories about how he originally got cast and what it was like to make the first Ghostbusters movie with Harold Ramis and Ivan Reitman, the director. He talks about shooting in New York, his initial reaction to the script, and when he realized the cultural impact of the film and why it was so hard for him to get roles after Ghostbusters' incredible success in the 80s. He also shares some great stories about his incredible 50-year career in Hollywood, including some of his favorite roles, some that he turned down and some that he just didn't get. He also talks about working with the late Brandon Lee on The Crow and what he thinks of the upcoming reboot, stories about shooting The Hand That Rocked the Cradle, Fantasy Island with Ricardo Montalban, One Day at a Time, Different Strokes, and the new Quantum Leap TV reboot. We also talk about how he looks and sounds so good at age 78. He's definitely in great shape. So here we go. What a great guy. Ernie Hudson right here, right now on Talk is Jericho.
How are you, man?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
Good. I'm glad we're able to get this rolling. We were going to be doing it a couple days ago, and you got called off to London.
Yeah. We were there kind of nonstop for about 2 or 3 days and back home now and able to kind of catch my breath. So it's good.
Well, it's interesting. I got a text yesterday just randomly from my friend who didn't know that you and I were going to be talking today. And it's a picture of you. And he said, how can Ernie Hudson be 78 years old? You look fit, slim and trim. I mean, my boy's in good shape here, man.
Well, you know, at a certain point in life, you realize that, you know, if you want to be around for a while, you want to be around in a healthy state. So That little bit of, you know, every day makes a big difference. So I'm I feel great and it's a good time.
It's almost your job to be fit, you know, as far as being an actor and for the parts you can play and that sort of thing as well.
Yeah, but I think in the past, early on, I noticed that if I put weight on, I would probably work more.
Really?
Yeah. Sometimes people, you know, if I'm in a movie and they got a guy who's in decent shape, but he's not as in good a shape as I am, it creates a conflict in some people's minds.
Right.
So they want me to be the kind of the guy there, but not look like I'm the guy who can do what this guy does. So most of my career, I've never been able to kind of take off my shirt. I'm usually in suits I did Oz. I was the only one on the show who didn't have to get naked. I mean, it's everybody. Was, so I don't know what that's about. I put a T-shirt on this press tour, and I was amazed at the reaction because people don't normally see me, I guess, without a suit and tie.
But once again, I mean, you've got such career longevity and played so many different roles with so much diversity. I think that not having to take your shirt off hasn't hurt you in the least.
Yeah, no, I'm. I got no complaints though. But as I get older, I realize sometimes you need to do that just to remind people that, yeah, I'm of a certain age, but I'm not frail. You know, people will offer to help me stand. I'm like, you know what? I think I got that. So not right now. So, but yeah, no, people assume certain things, especially when they hear a certain number.
But that's the thing, sorry to interrupt you, Ernie, is like, that's kind of the world we live in now, which is really cool. It's inspirational. I'm 53, but when I see, you know, you're 78 and active and playing all these great parts, the Stones are touring this summer, Mick and Keith are 80.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the level has risen as far as what age even means in show business.
I think so. I think, and for a lot of people. Now, of course, that doesn't apply to everyone. A lot of the habits that we start early on begin to reflect when you start getting your 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. 70s, some of that stuff comes back to haunt you. But in general, yeah, the number doesn't mean, you know, what we used to think it did, except with a lot of people, it still does. I mean, I have friends who are much younger than I am who are having difficult times. So, and also we don't all age the same way. So
right.
I can't take credit for necessarily where I am. I can take credit for the work that I put into it, but there's some genetic things at play as well.
Sure, sure. Was it different when you first started? I know you've been acting since the 70s. I mean, you just think how the world was in the 70s when you hit, you know, 40-year-old and you're retiring at 55. Was it like that for the acting business when you first started?
Yeah. I mean, this country's always been sort of youth-oriented. You know, we want to see the new, the youth.
Right.
But you got to realize, when we did Ghostbusters, I was pretty close to 40. I'm not sure how old I was, but you know, I wasn't a kid at that time. But then I really, for the most part, I haven't been the focus of the movie. So mm-hmm. The wonderful thing about acting as a career is, you know, there are parts for all kinds of people. So it's not like you have to, unless you become an action hero, and then you have to maintain an image.
Right, 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 right.
And I always say, I never had roles designed for me, for the most part. I've had to fit into whatever was sort of presented, which is okay. It's work, but I have some friends who, you know, things were sort of written for them, tailor-made for them, and that's a different ballgame.
This is the textbook definition of a character actor, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's my job is to tell the story. And if in this story the guy is, you know, he's a funny guy, then I got to make somebody laugh. If it's a dramatic thing, somebody's got to cry. My job is to tell the story as effectively as I can.
Obviously, the movie is Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, but you mentioned when you did Ghostbusters, the original one, you were almost 40. What did you think when you first heard about this movie? And obviously, it's one of the most endearing franchises in Hollywood history. No one really knows for sure when you first show up, but you come into this movie with these three giant, you know, comedians. How was that for you fitting with those guys, and how did you get that role in the first place?
You come to Hollywood, you're hoping to land a job, and you're assuming if you get a big job that the doors are going to open and everything is going to be great. I did a movie called Space Hunter with Ivan Reitman. Harold Ramis was one of the writers on it. A year before, Peter Strauss and Molly Ringwald were, you know, starring in it. And so I assumed when Ghostbusters came up, I'd be able to sort of get in. But it took a long time to convince them. I went through probably 6 auditions. I think they felt that the character I played in Space Hunter, which is a little bigger than life kind of character, wouldn't fit the Ghostbuster situation. But eventually, I was able to convince them. And of course, the movie came out. It was a huge hit. But work dried up for me. It's almost like it was the opposite of what I imagined. And I realize a lot of people come to Hollywood hoping, and we have these expectations, but it doesn't always unfold the way. But I've always, I mean, this is what I do. So I've always been able to sort of readjust. Up until Ghostbusters, I've done a few films, a lot of theater. When Ghostbusters came out and the films weren't open, I started doing a lot of TV. I did, you know, Little House on the Prairie and Bosom Buddies and Taxis, and worked a lot in television until I got a movie called Weeds with Nick Nolte, and then I got back into features. But it took about 3 years to get back to work the way I wanted to get back to work.
It's amazing, too. Like you said, Ghostbusters is such a huge hit. You're thinking, okay, the offers are going to come rolling through the door now.
Yeah, yeah. That and the second Ghostbusters, the same thing happened. The movie came out. I did 8 movies back to back, and then we did the second Ghostbuster, and then nothing until The Hand That Rocks the Cradle came up. And then in The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, it was kind of hard getting an interview because they saw me as the guy in Ghostbusters, and here's a guy who's sort of mentally challenged.
Right.
And it's a very different character. So finally, we were able to get the interview, but Ghostbusters almost cost me that job. So it's a weird business, and you got to roll with it.
Talk about the first Ghostbusters when you were filming that. And obviously you're working with Bill and Dan and Harold Ramis. Was it your job to be more of the straight man with those three guys, do you feel? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, those guys are, I mean, first off, I think they're brilliant, all of them in their own different way. Bill Murray comes up with stuff that I don't know where it comes from. It's pretty hilarious. And Danny sort of is just this nonstop creative engine. Harold was sort of the magma that pulled everything together. And Ivan Reitman, who produced and directed, just had this wonderful way of identifying what's funny. We do scenes, but when it was there, he kind of knew it. Not all directors sort of have that ability. So my kind of coming in, I felt like a cousin visiting from out of town. But I've always felt that, and getting into acting, that I'm bringing something that nobody else can bring. And so I know what I do. I can be funny if I need to be funny. I can be whatever I need to do. So I never felt like out of place. It was more convincing the studio because, you know, they want the focus to be where they want it to be. So, but it was fun. And the guys, from day one, just really sort of embraced me. I feel very close to each and every one of them, but it was a challenge, not because of the work as much as, you know, I think the studio sometimes understanding that it's okay that we can all be funny. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Right.
Sometimes the backers of the movie, I don't say the studios, and this is things have changed a bit, but they want, you know, the attention to be where they want it to be. So, you know, you're not meant to be the guy who's funny. This is the guy who's going to get this. So,
right.
You know what I mean? If you're in, like I was saying, if I'm in better shape than, you know, this guy, he's supposed to be the guy who can sort of defeat the world. Then somehow you got to sort of get me out of the way. And so it's always a balancing act, but it's also an ensemble. And like I said, my job is to not try to think about stealing a scene as much as making this believable. Because that's the integrity of what we do. So I get where you want the focus. Now, being in Ghostbusters, you got a lot of funny guys, and everybody wants the line that is going to be going to
sure.
Resonate. And I look back on it now, 40 years later, and I had some great lines. You know, I think if I'm on the street and people ask me about the big Twinkie, or, you know, someone asks if you're a god, you know, it was great. And they were very good. The guys were very good about sharing and making sure that I was included. And I'm forever really grateful for that.
Was there a lot of improv on that set? You know, Bill Murray in 84 was kind of at his peak.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, like I said, Billy was, I mean, he was, you know, the heart. He kind of carried it. Yeah, you know, we would do the script that was as written. You know, it was a written script, so we weren't just out there making stuff up.
Sure.
But then after we got that in the can, Ivan would go like, okay, let's, and Billy would just come up with stuff out of, that was amazing. Harold Ramis told me when they were doing Groundhog Day that Harold directed, when it came to Bill's scenes, they didn't even write anything because they knew that he would bring
right
bring to it that they couldn't imagine. So it was, yeah, it was improv, but it was also, you know, kind of open to that sort of free flow, and some of the things were great, but then we also had a great script too. So it never felt like we were. I've done movies where you kind of go, we're making it up as we go along, and that wasn't the case with Ghostbusters.
Let's talk about Harold Ramis for a little bit. I was a huge fan of his from SCTV. I grew up in Canada, obviously, the comedy troupe with John Candy and Rick Moranis, et cetera, et cetera. Rick was in Ghostbusters as well. But
right.
Harold Ramis, kind of a underrated genius in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I think, well, his stamp is, you know, his print is all over Ghostbusters, and a lot of the movies he's made. And Harold was, but he was just sort of the adult in the room. You know what I mean? He was kind of, you know, he was funny, but he was always very approachable and welcome. And I credit him with a large part to how I've been able to sustain over these almost 60 years in the business. Just how he conducted himself on the set, how he people would kind of have their issues with each other. Like I said, it was like family, but everybody would listen to Harold. He was the one that people would kind of go, okay, and it would sort of kept it together because everybody respected him that much. And when there were things going on that I just didn't understand why it's what the hell, and Harold would be the guy who would say, Ernie, it's okay. You know, and he would kind of explain things, and it's like, okay. So Harold was always the go-to guy. And like I said, I just, not so much someone telling you as much as I observe, and I just love the way he always conducted himself to with everybody. You know, certain people would have their, they come to the set and they're in a different mood today, and so you got to adjust for that. So, but Harold was consistent. I always appreciated him and considered him, well, I consider all the guys friends, but just very, very different people.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, that you learned kind of from watching Harold about how to conduct yourself on the set. And you've been in the business, you mentioned, better part of 50 years. Has there been other people that you've watched on the set that you've learned from and how to conduct yourself or how not to conduct yourself?
Yeah. No, over the years. I mean, I love Bill Murray. I would watch how he would deal with the fans. You know, we'd be shooting in New York and car would just hit its brakes and the guy would jump out of the car with it still running, run over and Bill and hug Bill. And Bill was always so gracious about it. I thought that was really kind of cool because I've worked with a lot of people who just would be freaked out or just not tolerant. But Bill was always kind of, I just love the way he handled himself, you know, on the set. But when I first came to L.A., one of the jobs I got was Fantasy Island with Ricardo Montalban. I got this part. I get to the set and Howard Duff, and it was a lot of the big TV stars, you know, when I was a kid watching on TV. So, and they would always have these celebrity guests, you know, featured on the show.
Right.
So, and they were, it was, I mean, these are people I'd watched as a little kid. I was like a little, maybe not intimidated, but I didn't feel I had anything to say. So when I wasn't working, I'd go to my dressing room. And the first day I was there, I was in my dressing room at lunchtime. And I get this knock on the door. And it's Ricardo Montalban. And he says, welcome. And he goes, just like on the show. And he says, come. And he takes me around where everybody's eating. And he says, this is, you know, Ernie, and was so blessed to have him and here. And he introduced me and he said, he said a thing there and he brought the, he was just so kind to me. And I'm always impressed when someone doesn't have to be kind.
Right.
You know, someone feels like, okay, you can do something for them. But when you're kind of, and he just, and I thought that's the way, in fact, he's the only actor I ever wrote a thank you note to.
Really?
Yeah, I just, and of course, when people see him accept you, then everybody else is like, oh, you know, it's.
Sure.
And I saw him a little before he passed, and he was kind enough to pretend he remembered that. I don't know if he did or not, but he just was such a gracious man. And I always thought if I ever get in position, I want to be like that. Yeah, you're always watching, you're always learning. You know, sometimes people don't realize the impact. And you also learn what not to do. I mean, I've seen some weird behavior and. But you're always thankful for the people who teach without even sometimes knowing that's what they're doing.
You talk about the original Ghostbusters, and you talk about the effects when you guys are capturing ghosts and that sort of thing. I mean, obviously now it's all a lot of CGI and that sort of thing. But how were you doing it back then for the first Ghostbusters?
Well, it was pretty much practical. So it was a lot of the, I don't want to say puppets, but, you know, a lot of, we had something practical to look work at, off. Yeah. Now it's all CGI, so you know what it's going to look like. But even with the practical stuff, you know, the 60-foot marshmallow man, I'm like, what does that look like? You know, and he's climbing up the building, and you're trying to, you know, you're shooting the thing, but it's like, and you hope this looks right. But at least you kind of knew a little bit about, I remember the second Ghostbusters, we have the train sequence where we're in the tracks there and we're walking, and then we hear the sound of the train coming, and then you look up and it's a locomotive and it hits me, and I get hit by the train, and it's just so, it's actually a really funny scene, I think. But I was trying to get an idea of what the train looked like. And so Ivan Reitman, who was directing it, said, you know, just imagine a big locomotive train just coming down the track and it just plows into you. And so I reacted like if I was being hit by a train. And then when I saw the movie, it was like a little choo-choo train. It was not a big locomotive, you know, so sometimes it comes out a little bit different. The scene still worked, but it was not quite what I had in mind. And sometimes you're watching a movie and you go, oh, that's what that was.
Right.
But if you have the practical thing, like if there's somebody, if they build the dogs that you're going to transform into, you know, it's just a little easier to play off things that are as much of the toys as you can get. It always helps. It helps, you know, just the play acting, the sure. imagination. But a lot of stuff, I remember doing a movie, Congo, and we had the lava flowing, but it's pretty much green screens, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to avoid the
you
know, yeah, but that's the fun of it, you know?
You know, when and I was thinking too, like when you're reading the script for Ghostbusters 1 and it says like 60-foot tall marshmallow man, you're probably thinking, what?
Yeah.
What is this going to be?
But when you see it, then you go, oh, but that's after the fact. And then your reaction is sometimes, you know, if it's done well, it's appropriate. But sometimes it's I did a movie, it's called Mad Bull with Alex Price. And I played a wrestler. This is early on as well. And so we had the scene and they're in this cage and they're wrestling and this. And the guy's trying to describe it and you're trying to react, but they're not there.
Right.
And the actor who was in the scene with me, he just sort of sat there watching. He wasn't doing anything. And I was still, oh, come on. And then when we saw the actual match, and it's on camera now, and you can't take it back, and you went like, oh. It's always an issue. But it always helps to have the practical, something to play off of.
Like you said, too, the interesting, like when you see it on screen, you can't take it back. Are you ever worried, like, what the edit's going to do? Am I going to make it? I like that scene.
Yeah. I've seen some really not so great actors give great performances because they'll take 50 takes. You get that one take that's great, and suddenly this guy's being nominated for something, and you kind of go, really? And some really good actors kind of come off okay because we got it, and they don't want to take the time to move on. When the director says, well, I want you to do this thing, you kind of go, I don't know, man. I don't think so. Say, no, trust me. Okay. And then you try to do it because my face is on the screen. You know, your name in the titles. So, and trust you, and if it doesn't work, and I'm not feeling it's not how I'm seeing the character. And a couple times, and I won't mention names, but you kind of go, I wish I had just followed my own instinct. And I think the better actors trust their own instinct.
Yeah.
I've been working with actors, and the director says, can you do it like this? And they go, sure. And they do exactly what they did. You know, they'll do exactly because they go, nope. And they'll agree, oh, yeah, no, make it bigger. Yeah, but they keep doing the same thing. I'll at least try because I want to trust the director is seeing something that I'm not seeing. But sometimes when it goes against your spirit,
Yeah, I know in wrestling when we do the backstage promos, if someone suggested it in a way that I didn't like it, I always just swear at the end of it. That way I know they couldn't use it.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
fuck.
Yeah.
Now, I know they're not going to use that one.
They made decisions. That's the other thing about performance, because you got so many things affecting that performance out of your control.
What was it like for you then when they call you again for Afterlife and then for Frozen Empire? You haven't been in Ghostbusters for, you know, almost 40 years. Was it cool to reprise that? Interesting putting on the jumpsuit again?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, because the fans have been so loyal. I mean, amazingly so. You know, because after 5 years and 10 years, 15, 20 years, people were still wearing the jumpsuits and turning the cars and ectomobiles. So when I got called to do Afterlife, and we did the one with the ladies before that, And then we did Afterlife. I thought it was would never happen because it's been so many years. And when I saw Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd in their jumpsuits and we walk on stage together, it was almost emotional. I mean, I thought, wow, you know, this movie's such an impact on my life. And now here we are, it's actually happening. Now, when we did this Frozen Empire, you know, I already had that experience not that long ago. So it wasn't so much seeing the guys in their suits as much as suddenly I was able to look around and see the new cast and thought, wow, it's really great to see it sort of moving forward into a new space. It's not just trying to hold on to what we did, but this new cast is great. And I was really it was just great watching them and discovering who they are. Because I think in Afterlife, we kind of came in the end and I didn't have time to spend with Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon and McKenna Grace and, you know, to see who they were and how they operate. Every actor kind of creates in a different way. But that was the wonderful thing about this last film, was just thinking, yeah, wow, these guys, if it goes forward, it's in great hands.
It's also a testament to how beloved the original cast is to be back in this movie with the new cast.
Yeah. That I appreciate, you know, like I said, the studio has changed. And also, you know, 40 years, I realized we're playing to, it's not the same audience.
Right.
You know, the world has changed. I mean, we're at a place very different than, you know, in 1984. Mm-hmm. It's great to still be there, still be viable, and to not be in a project just because the studio wants to do something and make money, but there's an audience who really wants to see it happen. And that was for me, the real reason for doing it.
I'm sure you've been asked this before. Have you ever had any ghost encounters, ghost experiences?
Yeah, I think so. I grew up in a family that believed in ghosts and, you know, visitations and all kinds of stuff. And there are things that I probably couldn't explain. I don't sort of play with it. Over the years, I've been like, you know what? If there is a ghost, I'm okay. I'm fine. Right. But for the longest time, I remember shooting a movie called Speechless with Gina Davis and Michael Keaton. And they put us up, we were shooting in Hollywood. They put us up at the Roosevelt Hotel. Mm-hmm. And I got in the hotel at about 2 o'clock in the morning. I wake up and I see something rush across the room. It's like it was dark, but it was almost like somebody just ran through the room. And I'm like, what the hell? And I turn the lights on, there's nobody there. And I lay back down. And then it's like this shuffling of things. And I see it pass again, and I'm like, okay, no, hell no. So I got up. I literally checked out of the hotel. It's like, no, I'm not going to sleep. I have to go. Some things, you know, maybe there's an explanation for it, but I can't figure it out. So I'm going to. Also, I believe that we only have 5 senses, and if it doesn't register in one of those senses, then we assume it doesn't exist. And I'm pretty sure there's a lot going on around us than we can even imagine.
I stay at the Roosevelt all the time, and the I think it's room 908 that's supposed to be where the ghost of Montgomery Clift plays trumpet in the hallway. I've waited many times. I never saw him yet.
Right, yeah. I was up in Winnipeg shooting.
Oh, that's where I'm from.
Oh, really? Yeah. We shot Champions with Woody Harrelson. And
oh, no kidding.
Charlie's, right? Yeah, but we were in this hotel. It's the oldest hotel up there. It's supposed to be haunted.
Fort Garry, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it was a great hotel, but it's over 100 years old. It's like, but there was one room that a girl supposedly getting married killed herself or something. Anyway, she's been seen in the room, and people have, you know, reported covers ripped off their beds and all kinds of weird stuff. So they asked me, would I take a photo in the room? And I'm like, sure. But I thought, you know, you have the Winnipeg Ghostbusters. I mean, it's a whole little group here. Why don't we invite them to come, and then we'll do like a Ghostbuster thing in the room. And they were excited. So the Winnipeg Ghostbusters, they come, we get the cameras there, and they got their backpack, their little Ghostbuster proton packs. And we go in the room, and all of a sudden we hear this weird noise. Everybody kind of look around. And then it was like the lights kind of flickered. And these guys were out of that room so fast. I'm like, holy, we're Ghostbusters. Where are you going? You know,
they just thought it was cool to put the outfits on. They weren't they weren't banking on that, those Winnipeg Ghostbusters.
But it's all fun. And I think a lot of the ghost hunting groups have come from being kids watching Ghostbusters and been inspired by it. So that's great.
What do you think the appeal is of Ghostbusters to be 40 years of people just going crazy and still so many movies and spinoffs? Why do you think it works so well?
Well, first off, it deals with a basic primal fear we all have. We all know at some point we got to check out.
Yeah.
We know that none of us know anything about check out to where, what. You know, we have people saying they think they know, but nobody knows. And so that's a basic fear, I think, as kids, who's in the closet when the lights are out. So it taps into that primal fear that we don't really discuss a lot. But I think the real appeal is it crosses generations. And I see old great-grandparents, grandparents watching with their grandkids. Some people now in their 50s say it's the first movie they ever saw with their dad or whatever. So it's something that brings people together that we can all share and find something to laugh about. Not many movies do that. I've done movies that appeal to a certain group, but not necessarily. Like The Crow, it has a huge following, but teenagers really kind of loved it, but you couldn't share it with your grandparents. But Ghostbusters is one of those movies that, it just crosses generations. And I was at a convention, I can't remember where it was, but it was this family, and they had a little 10-month-old baby, and they had a Ghostbuster jumpsuit on with a little tag. It was perfect. It was beautiful. And I asked her, "Mom, where'd you guys find this jumpsuit?" And the mother said, "I made it for him, the dad, when he was a baby, and now his baby is good." You know, and that's what I think the families can really come together and share it and laugh. And to me, that's the not many movies really can do that. I do Quantum Leap. I think it has kind of a family dynamic as well that you can share. But Ghostbusters especially does that.
You've done so much work, Ernie, and you mentioned The Crow. Let's talk about that. Obviously, you know, the star of Brandon Lee was huge at the time, and then he passes away during the filming of the movie. Talk about Brandon Lee, for one, and then kind of talk about what you remember about what happened on set with him.
Well, you know, Brandon was a great guy. I met him probably a few years, I don't know how many. I was shooting a television show in Vancouver with Miguel Ferrar, and they had been good friends. And Brandon was coming from China, doing some work in China, stopped through Vancouver, and spent a few days just sort of hanging out. So I kind of got to know him. And then when this movie came up, I was told that he had wanted me to do it.
Oh, wow.
They reached out to me. And but I loved Brandon. He was such a down-to-earth guy. And what I loved about him, he was just so inclusive. You know, he really took the time with everybody. He was, a lot of times you work with people and when they're not shooting, they want to get off into their trailer. I tend to do that as well sometimes. But Brandon just had a way of being a part and welcoming everybody. And the thing I probably most remember, and I love working with him, we really had a lot of fun in that scene where he shows up at my apartment. Uh-huh. And I think I'm in my underwear, my hat or something. But just before he died, and I wasn't there on the set when he died, but my wife's brother passed away like the day or so before. And we were flying to Minnesota the next day. And we had dinner with Brandon. We had already scheduled. So we had dinner with Brandon. And he was very, very nice to my wife. And then he and I got into a side conversation. I've been doing this for a while and a little bit frustrated because I hadn't gotten the shots that I felt I wanted to. And he was really sort of encouraging to me, saying, "Hey, in there," because he had just signed a 3-picture deal with Paramount. He had all these amazing things. He was getting married as soon as the film was over. They had bought a house. It just, life was great. And if I just don't lose the faith, it can happen for me as well. And then we flew to Minnesota, and literally when I got to my in-law's place, the phone was ringing to say that Brandon had passed. I still have a hard time sort of understanding how that can happen. But he was a very, very nice young man, and I don't think I wanted to go back and finish the movie. In fact, I know I didn't, but I got a call from the special effects guy, reminding me of how hard Brandon had worked on the movie and that he would want us to. And I'm so glad we did, because I think the movie just shows the potential he had. He's great in the movie. And But it's, yeah, you know, you don't, in this business, you don't expect everybody actually to get hurt. I mean, you know, this is, we make it look difficult, but, and so when something like that happens, it's just, I know they're making, they made a couple others, and there's one coming out now. But honestly, Brandon was the pro, and now James O'Barr, he's a friend. He kind of created the comic. I'm happy for him that they're making more movies, and I hope they are successful. But honestly, me personally, Brandon was a crow, and
he was the crow for you, yeah.
That's it for me.
Do you feel like it's so interesting too? Because obviously, his father is Bruce Lee, dies young. Brandon dies young. Do you feel that he had the star power to become a legit leading man? Major star, yeah.
Yeah. No, he and he was, you know, had done a bunch of stuff that he didn't feel that great about. He did one with, I think, Dolph Lundgren. Showdown Little Tokyo or something, I think it was called. And then, like some of the things I've done, he had some stupid lines. And one of them was selling Dolph, he had the biggest, you know, that he'd ever seen or something, which is just an awful line, but the director wanted the line. So finally, this was his chance to show what he could do. And I think, I think he would have been. There's a line I read in a script that was sent to me about, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans.
Right.
And I just think about Brandon and all the just things that were. And then suddenly we never know. And it was, you know, it's just heartbreaking even now, you know, all these years later. So
you mentioned the hand that rocks the cradle and the character you played having mental issues. How did you tackle a character like that? Because there's a lot of ways you could play that, but to play it straight and serious is probably very, very difficult.
Yeah, Hollywood Pictures, we tried to get an audition. They didn't see me as a character. The character was written as a, not small, but an Irish red hair, freckle.
Interesting.
Character, very different than who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I got a hold of the script through an agent, and I just knew I really, really want to do this role. But we had trouble because I think they didn't see me. And also they were seeing people who had mental disabilities. But finally I got an audition, Curtis Hanson, who's hands down, I think, probably the best director I've ever worked with. Best in the sense that I felt I could communicate and, you know, that we work well together. I got the audition and went in, and I thought it was a great audition, but the studio wasn't convinced. Number one, it took place in the South, and they felt by casting an African American, it would seem like they're making a comment about black men or something. You know, just it didn't look well. But then they decided they were not going to shoot in the South. They shot it in Seattle, so that kind of changed that. But then they still weren't totally convinced, so I had to go back in. And Curtis, you know, on the second, he really wanted me for the movie. So he sent me a tape of the audition. They had seen a lot of people who were mentally disabled. That was really helpful to kind of get a sense of it. I think they realized they needed an actor because they got one young man who was just brilliant, but when they asked him to stand up and take some direction, it just all fell apart.
Right.
But once I got the role and I knew that I had to sort of do some research, and also there are places in Los Angeles and the surrounding area of Riverside where they have these gatherings on Friday nights. And so I went to some of the homes and got to know some of the kids or people. Shouldn't call them kids, but. And I went to, I remember going to one of the Friday night dances. And as I walked in, they were so welcoming. And one young lady came and hugged me. And I thought, oh, it's because I'm a Ghostbuster. But no, it was like they were that way with everybody.
Right.
But I met a young man who was high functioning, I guess. You know, he really could draw amazingly well. I mean, it was. And I kind of modeled the character a little bit on my impression of him. And that was really, really very, very helpful. And I think as an actor, once you get a sense of the character's rhythm, then it's not a matter of right or wrong. You just sort of got to tap into that. And I loved working on that. I saw Rebecca De Mornay recently at an award show, and it was so great to run into her because I thought she was just wonderful. I'm very thankful to have gotten the chance to play that. Because also one of the problems as actors, once Hollywood sort of sees you a certain way, it becomes difficult to be seen in a different light. And so that was, it was one of those that I was really happy to do.
I'd say that's probably a quite a big victory for you as an actor, because like you said, like casting is 90% of when you walk into the room and just looking at you, it's like, well, you, okay, this guy's an African-American big guy. We wanted a small redheaded Irish guy. It's going to, you're going to have to be extra amazing to sway them.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to turn around. One, I remember one of the comments were, they didn't believe that I would let not little, but a woman like Rebecca De Mornay slap me and not react to it. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, yeah, but you're thinking about me, but you're forgetting this, the character. That's a different scenario. I mean, it's, and if you get to the heart of the character, then you can understand. I mean, it's about humanity, how that happens. And I remember being, I think we're at Disney, it was one of the previews, and I saw the reviewers for the reviewers, and went in and I watched it with them, and they were just totally into the movie and reacting, you know, to different things. And then the reviews came out the next day, and almost they all sort of panned it. I'm like, I was in the room. I mean, so sometimes it doesn't fit what critics think a movie should be, even though they enjoy it. It's almost like a Ghostbuster. You're never going to get nominated for an award, but they really love it, you know, so... But yeah, I'm one of those movies I'm very thankful to have gotten the chance to play that character.
You've done so much stuff, like we've mentioned. What's the secret to being a steadily working actor? Because it's such a push and pull industry. Like you said, you're in Ghostbusters and they don't work again for another 8 months or whatever it is. And then here you are almost 50 years later.
Yeah, no, it was almost 3 years of not working in film after the first Ghostbusters. But first off, you know, I grew up in a church, and one of the sayings, I think it's a biblical saying, put not your trust in man. So I've never really trusted my career to happen because of someone, you know, getting a favor from. And it happens from people, but it comes from places that in people who sometimes you never even really know. So I just know that there's a kind of a universal guidance. There's a that will guide me if I can quiet myself long enough to sort of tune in. If I prepare myself and be ready for an opportunity. I remember once back in the day, it was a day off and I had nothing to do, and with some friends, and they smoked some weed, and I took a couple hits off of it, and I was like, and then the phone rang and I had to go to this audition. And I thought, I will never, ever do that again. You know, you just have to. But I think just trusting and doing the work. A lot of people want it to happen, and it's a feeling of I'll do the work when I have a reason to do it, when I get a job, if I know that's going to be. But it's really about being prepared. And for me, it comes from a biblical story of these brides. I don't remember how many there were waiting for the groom, and they didn't know what hour he would come. It was sort of an analogy of Christ will come at a time.
Right.
You don't know.
Right.
So, but a number of them had fallen asleep or who hadn't prepared, but it was just one who had prepared and she was ready and waiting. So when the groom came, she was the one that he chose. And so I think sometimes you got to trust that it's going to happen. Let me do the work. And that's what I've always sort of tried to be ready when the opportunity comes, and knowing that the opportunity definitely will come. I do believe there's a universal spirit, and I do believe there's guidance. Because honestly, I'm not that clever enough to be able to figure out how to have a career in Hollywood. People ask me, and I'm like, I don't know. I just show up and do the work. So, yeah.
With such an extensive body of work, do you still have to audition sometimes?
No, I don't do it anymore. I mean, I get asked to do it, but I'm like, you know what? I mean, if you can't,
that's right.
You can't go and stream a movie that I'm in and see. Honestly, and a lot of times when they ask me, that means there's somebody else they really want.
Right.
But just in case we can't get Danny Glover, we'll have Ernie go on tape. Yeah. I'm like, no. You gotta know who I am. And if you don't know who I am after all these years, then I don't know if I want to work with you.
Yeah.
So now it's got to be a reason to want to do it. To work just to work, it doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. So I love working, but you know, if I got to beg you for a job, I don't want to be there.
Let's talk about some of your work here. Some of my favorite TV shows of all time you worked on. Did you have any memories of when you were on, let's say, One Day at a Time?
Yeah. No, they all kind of come back. It was, I think I played a cop on that.
Desk sergeant.
I know everybody was Valerie Bertinelli, who was the kid on the show.
Yeah.
She did Touched by an Angel. I was doing an RV trip with my kids. We were going across country. And literally as we got into Salt Lake City, I got a call saying they wanted me on that show. And she was on that show. It was good to see her again. But yeah, no, it was... like I said, it was during that time when I couldn't get a movie, and I did a lot of, it was 1 year, it felt like I was doing a different TV show every week. I mean, it wasn't a bad time. It wasn't the work, because I wanted to be in movies. I wanted to work mostly in movies, but it was a great time to be working.
What about Different Strokes? You played Kwame.
Yeah, I think it was going to be a spinoff of Different Strokes.
Really?
We're going to do the spinoff, and it was about this international school, and I don't know how it tied into Different Strokes, but I played an African student who was studying to be a doctor or something. I don't know, but it didn't get picked up. But it was an episode of Different Strokes. But the kids, I met the kids. You know, I worked with different shows, different kids over the years, and some were really kind of tragic what happened, but because they were all such sweet kids at the time. And,
yeah.
It's kind of unfortunate how things unfolded in their lives, but it was a lot of fun too. And I was a fan of the show too, so it was great to be on it.
As we start to wind down, Ernie, was there any roles that you're up for that you didn't get that still bug you to this day?
I don't know if it bugs me. It's just something, because I think things have a way of working out the way they should.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I did a television series called 10-8. We did, I think, 15 episodes. And then some unfortunate things that I didn't want to talk about, people misbehaving, whatever. Anyway, the show was canceled. And Shonda Rhimes was a Shonda Rhimes project that later turned into Grey's Anatomy. And they wanted me to come in and read for the head surgeon that I think Bill Pickens plays. And I thought, you know, it's for ABC. I just did a series for ABC. I met with her. And I think the meeting went well. So why don't we have to go in here and read for this thing? So, you know, to me, it's like, I'm going to go in. And so I said, no, I didn't read for it. And then they cast Bill Pickens, who's now doing his, I think, 18th year or something on the series. And I can't even imagine. You know, you think about money and think, man, that would have been like.
Yeah.
I think it was Family. Urkel was on.
Oh, Family Matters.
Family Matters, yeah. They had really wanted me to come in. I'm like, I don't think I want to do that. That's not going to really work. And of course, so you look at some of them, but not so much that I miss, I think, playing the parts as much as I think financially it might have been a different world, you know. But I don't know anything that I remember Candyman getting a thing and they wanted me to come in. And I just thought, no, some things just don't make sense, which basically is saying it's not right for you. And Tony Todd did it, and I couldn't even imagine it working. And I saw the movie, and he's wonderful in it. So
yeah,
no, but nothing that I lost to. Whenever I sort of lost a part to someone, I figure it was meant for them to.
That's what William Shatner told me. He said, if I worried about the gigs I didn't get over the years, I'd drive myself crazy.
That's right, yeah. No, it all adds up. I've been good, and some careers have done, but I realize those are different people.
Right.
But a lot of the guys who are working, who I remember when they first started, you know, I was already out here and then their careers take off, and I kind of go, why and how? But this is not a business to answer why and how. It is what it is.
Well, last few things here, Ernie. Obviously, once again, we keep talking about your career. What do you have coming up? Do you just take the gigs that feel right? Are you still pounding the pavement looking for stuff?
No. I think luckily, thankfully, I've been able to make a good enough living to where I like to think, unless I do something really crazy, like buy a jet or something, I should be all right. So it really, I love working, but it has to make sense. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a reason. I used to say that all the time and never really could live up to it. When I started years ago, I remember Howard Rollins, we did the Martin Luther King story together. But Howard wouldn't work unless it was really, I had kids, so I got to take the right gig. But I felt Denzel was really selective. And I haven't always been selective. I just believe work gets work. And so I just work. But now it has to be, why am I doing this? You know, and I got to be able to explain that. Otherwise, I don't have 6 months to go and work on a project someplace I don't want to be.
Right.
Even 3 months or 3 weeks. I mean, you know, at my age now, we know there is a term limit. And why am I going to be in some city freezing my butt off for what? Another credit? You know,
right.
Unless there's a reason. I just have to have a reason to do it. A good reason is a great role. I'll sacrifice everything for the right role that I don't feel I've had. Or it's great money that I could really be life changing, or some great production team, director, whatever, that I really respect that work so much that I just wanted to work with them. And if it's not one of those things, you got no money, I don't know who you are, you know, it's not a great role, why am I doing this again? You know, so, but yeah, no, it's a good time now. So I'm just really, you know, if something comes up, you know, probably telling my agent, they go, well, but I think we can do better than that. I'm like, well, why don't you do it? So my goal is to, I'd love to do, I don't say a Christmas, but a holiday rom-com.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, and they go, well, that's, well, we can, you know, you don't need to do that. I'm like, yeah, but I never did that before. I'd like to do
it. You want
to
do it? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so, but it's a good time right now. And I'm very happy to have reached this point in my life where, yeah, where I can really say I love what I do and thankful to be able to do it.
Last two questions for you. What's your favorite role you ever played that maybe didn't get the spotlight that you thought it should have gotten?
Well, I don't think Solomon got the spotlight in Hannah Rocks the Cradle. Mm. I thought Congo would be a career changer.
Mm.
I love that character and nothing came out of that. You know, I did a weird little movie for some people who didn't really understand film. It's called Everything is Jake. It now even got a release. It's always hard to tell, you know, what does what. But those things, I felt if the Hannah Rocks the Cradle had got the critical attention, it might have been a game changer. But in the meantime, you know, you just keep on putting one foot in front of the other.
And last question for you. What's your favorite scene you've ever played in a Ghostbusters movie?
Well, I mentioned the train sequence. The first day of working, we did the big Twinkie scene. And that was fun because I was really, for the first time, getting a chance to sort of connect with all the guys. Yeah, they were all kind of fun. The mayor's office, you know, I have seen stuff that'll turn you white, that line.
Right.
But yeah, it was, you know, it was fun. We had a lot of fun.
Well, man, it's great talking to you, Ernie. And once again, congratulations on an amazing career. And I look forward to seeing what you do in the future. My wife is watching Modern Family, and I walked in last night, and there you are. It's like this guy's all over the place, man.
Yeah. No, that's from me. I'm a working actor.
That's it.
Ed O'Neill has been a friend for a long time. And, you know, I told him I did 3 episodes, but give me something to do. I mean,
right.
You know, just be here. But I'm glad I did it. I don't regret too much of anything. And, but a great talk to you too. And good luck, man, with everything. I mean, I really.
Thanks, man.
Enjoyed it.
If you ever get enough money to get that jet, give me a ride to Winnipeg.
You got it.
Thanks, Ernie. Take care, buddy.
All right. You take care. Bye-bye.
According to this morning's sample, it would be a Twinkie 35 feet long, weighing approximately 600 pounds.
That's a big Twinkie.